This is Phil Farron, and I am driving home. As you can hear, the air conditioning is running. We are officially in summer around here. We had a great run up to it, beautiful weather. But, you know, sooner or later, summer has to catch up with you, and it has caught up with us. Although, today, it's actually, the heat is a little bit off the day, and it's actually not too bad today. So, it is episode 331, since I rarely announce those. It's been a good week. It is Thursday today. I'm not planning on coming in tomorrow, because I'm starting my writing weekend. Yay! Good. I love this. Wow. Blessed. Anyways, everything's pottering along with my major client and the projects we're working on. I did a quick meet with the stakeholders, but the primary users on one of the projects that we've been working on. I've been sort of shepherding it, and another programmer has actually been working on the project. Unfortunately, he was out today. He hurt his back a couple of days ago, and he was out, but the people I wanted to meet with were going to be gone all next week to what is called general counsel for my major client. Things are going to be very quiet next week. They're going to be very, very quiet because everything will be going on at General Counsel, and a significant portion of the staff at the major client is out there and will be out there all week. And so I'm going to get a lot of stuff done next week. We're just going to plow through a lot of stuff. But anyway, so was able to meet with client on one of the projects we're working on. That went well. They were excited about what's coming down the pike. That's good. Everything made sense to them. Got a lot of good input on that. And then in the afternoon, had a couple of more meetings. We kicked off yet another little project, but everything seems doable. It's just a matter of lining them up and knocking them down, you know. But it's good. Everything's just good. Had a lovely breakfast this morning with a former teacher from the college I graduated from. We just had a wonderful time. Very interesting man, has lots of interesting investigations he's done into the human voice and to all the control that there is within the human voice, to our ability to speak and communicate with language and then sing. And it was fun getting caught up with him and hearing about all the really, really interesting things he's been investigating. So it's very, very fun breakfast. Aside from that, I've been writing. My wife, had a chance to kind of get some sleep and, you know, get a little recovery from having the grandkids all weekend, but our kids did get back from Chicago on Friday, and they brought gifts for my wife and me for watching over things while they were gone. We got a chance to get caught up and hear about all the cool stuff they did in Chicago. And so that was fun. It's just good to have them home. I mean, it's just good, you know. It's just nice to see them home. And so it's all is well there. I have been writing this week, was actually able, even with the grandkids, to hit my targets last week as for the number of words I wanted to get done. And that was completely because my wife took care of the grandkids while I was writing. So I popped up every once in a while to say hello and read a book here and there, but it really was her adventure. So, but she loves taking care of the grandkids, so that worked out just fine. I'm on Trigrid to hit all my stuff this week. I'm rapidly closing on the end of this book. It would be really good if I actually knew what the end of this book was going to be. I'm getting an inkling of a few things here and there. Theoretically, I'm wrapping it up in another 15,000 words or so, maybe. Not sure I'm going to be able to land it in that few words, because I have a few more things to kind of wrestle around and wrangle down. But if it goes a little bit over, I'm actually ahead of schedule, so I'm in pretty good shape for it. So I think we're good, because I don't really need to have my rough end done until September 1st. And if this roughs in like I think it's going to rough in, I should pretty well be under control by the second week of August, maybe the third week of August if it runs a little long. But that should give me, should give me plenty of time to go ahead and get the editing done and then get the cover put together. And then launch this one out to the beta readers and see what they think. And then as soon as I get that done, I've got to turn around and start on the next one. And it's a little foggy what's happening in the next one. But, you know, I just start writing and I just see what happens. And it's been working out so far. What's interesting is the next one, well, at least interesting for me, what's interesting is the next one is actually, when I get the next one done, it's actually the completion of the first half of the first octet. So I will be halfway through the first octet. And there are three octets, but still, you know, that's kind of an accomplishment to get halfway through that. And so just keep plowing through it, see what we can see. This is crazy. This is nuts. So many books. But keeps me happy. You know, I just get such joy out of writing. And I've got, I think, it's not, you know, you never know till you write it, but man, it feels like this book is going to land well. It just, I've got the epilogue, I think. I think I've got the epilogue, which is one of the kind of major things that I always shoot for. So I'm looking forward to writing it and seeing if the thing actually lands. But that should be coming up. If not, well, I'm hoping, if not this next week, then the next week. I'm hoping. That's the plan. We'll see whether that works out. What else? Aside from that, life is, it's good. I was reminded again today just how good life is. Man. It's good. You know, I look around some of the people around me and some of the difficulties they're going through, and I'm just thinking, man. They say, how are you doing? I just say, good. Really, really good. Everything's just fine. You know, learning just to be completely grateful for everything. Just reminding myself of all the things that could be worse. Just, it's good. So anyways, came across two different articles, day before yesterday? And I thought, well, you know, this is interesting. Because in one of the articles, I actually thought at first that I was going to offer a varying viewpoint. We won't say that I was going to be critical. We will say that I was going to offer a varying viewpoint to the first article. But after rereading the article, I thought, you know, they're actually saying what I have been saying for years. Which by years, I mean when I wrote Still Whispers when I turned 50, which I wrote Still Whispers in 2008. I was saying this in 2008, what this article is talking about. So that's 7 years ago I was saying this. And, you know, I find it reiterated here, and of course I agree with it because they agree with me. So, and then I came across another article that was the flip side of it. And honestly, what the things that they're saying in that article, I think we can do better. But in the last year, I feel like I've really come to a better understanding of those things. And so what I offer in terms of that article is not necessarily criticism so much as I think they're on the right path. They just haven't logically extended it enough yet. But we'll get there. We'll get there. The first article that I came across was called What the Trump and Cosby Allegations Reveal About Rape Culture. Which, you know, obviously Donald Trump is now making a run at the presidency. And there was, like, the Daily Beast magazine published a reminder for everybody that while Donald Trump and his wife were going through an ugly divorce, she actually accused him of raping her, of forcefully having intercourse with her when she didn't want to have intercourse. She, in the process of all that, kind of later said, well, she didn't really mean literal or criminal rape. And it happened many years ago. But the Daily Beast sought to publish it, obviously trying to get read, trying to get noticed, because that's their business, to get read and get noticed. And some have questioned whether or not it was appropriate for them to publish that. But of course it was appropriate in terms of their job is to get noticed, and they got noticed by publishing this. The author of the article does refer to that and does refer to some of the deposition. But whether or not what Donald Trump did to Ivana Trump could be classified as rape is not as important so much as the fact that there has been a history of comments that have been made by Donald Trump, where I think we have to recognize that Donald Trump is an equal opportunity offender, that when he makes the kind of comments that he made about Mexico and Mexico dumping all their rapists on us, when he, you know, lashes out at other candidates and says the types of things that he says, Donald Trump is a person of poor cheer, a popsy, as I call them. There's no question about that. And he's a person of poor cheer, not only with respect to men, but he is a person of poor cheer with respect to women. And how he treats women certainly should not be used as any kind of a standard or gold standard for behavior. Because it's not. Because Donald Trump is Donald Trump. And he is someone who is driven to a significant percentage by his flesh. And so, of course, the standard flesh lies are going to come out of his mouth when it comes to a fleshly man's view of a woman. Women in general. In addition to that, of course, you have the Cosby allegations that look more and more like they're true. This past week, was it the New Yorker actually had 35 different women on its cover, and all of these women have alleged that they were drugged and raped, or that maybe they didn't all allege that, but there was inappropriate behavior by Bill Cosby, which is a very sad thing to hear. And in this article, the female author of this article is trying to say, okay, this is what these things tell us about what's going on in a man's mind when he's doing this. And she comes to a conclusion which I very much agree with and have been talking about as something that men need to guard against, that men need to take an active role in denying for years. I mean, and these type of behaviors are not hard to spot. For instance, she quotes Trump, among bunches of other things, she quotes Trump as saying about his daughter, Ivanka, well, she does have a nice figure. I've said that if she wasn't my daughter, perhaps I'd be dating her. Well, what? What? Because that type of comment, that when someone makes that type of comment about their daughter, they don't think anything of it. They think, well, yeah, you know, someone looks good, that's because I'll date them. You know, because A, anyone that looks good, I'm entitled to have my way with them. Which really means anyone who looks good is an object for me to exploit. It's pure and simple, is what it is. So she goes on in the article, the author of the article, to talk about, well, what makes men rape? She said there's been something that's been missing from the conversation about rape that's been so prominent in media in recent years. Some of the focus, understandably, has been on the victims, what they need to survive, what kind of justice they're speaking, what it takes for them to be believed. She said, but we've hardly spoken at all about what's running through a man's head when he chooses to force himself on a woman, even though in many ways, the central question here, if men chose not to rape, I think we're missing a word, in many ways, the central question here, if men chose not to rape, it wouldn't happen in the first place. So, what is the popular conceptions about why men choose to rape? And she said, in the culture, we talk about the fact that rape is just kind of a thing men do by accident. Maybe they were confused by the woman's attire. Or, you know, maybe they're just following the example of the hookup culture. You know, that there's just an overabundance of lust in the world, and that's the problem, rather than men deliberately choosing to have sex with women who are unwilling or unable to consent. And she said, what the Donald Trumps and the Bill Cosbys of the world remind us of, and I think they do, is that the men in this world who know, that there are men in this world who know exactly what they're doing, men who rape not because they are really just horny that day or lost control, but because they enjoy overpowering women. Now, that's a true statement. And there's an even truer statement. But let me go through the rest of the article. She says that in a 2005 deposition Cosby gave to defend himself against the allegations of sexual abuse, he comes across, unwittingly or not, as an arrogant sexist who thinks that women are toys to be played with rather than autonomous people. It's not just his sexual exploits or even his own account, which even by his own account seem largely predicated on trying to get reluctant women into bed. He also routinely expresses contempt for women's ability to make their own choices about things like career and education. So what you see in men like this is you see this pervasive idea that women are different than men and that are in some ways inferior to men, and men are the superior species because of how we conceptualize of things and by how we make decisions, by how we move forward, etc., etc., etc. And, you know, that's very true. That there are men like that out there. And the author of the article said, maybe these rape allegations, as hard as they are to hear about, will serve as a wake-up call, helping Americans realize that rape isn't the result of excessive lust or a too casual sexual environment. It is the result of male entitlement, plain and simple. Now, I was confused about what exactly was meant by male entitlement, so I had to look that up and do some research. And as I understand it, in essence, one of the ideas of male entitlement is that men exist to service women, that a man is entitled to, in fact, have sex with any woman that he happens to see and he likes the way she looks. In fact, I have been saying since 2008 and before that one of the great battles that men face is the lie that the flesh tells them that women exist solely as a tool to help a man control his sperm count. It's right in Still Whispers, which was published in 2008. And that is a battle that we face as men. And so what I would add to this article is that because of the chemical processes in our brains, the flesh capitalizes on that. And one of the biggest battles every man who considers themselves to be heterosexual, one of the biggest battles that every man faces internally is to fight against this disposition that would seek to convince him that women are objects, that they exist simply as tools or as toys. And I recall a conversation that I had, and I probably would never have this conversation with what I know now, but a coworker, a young woman from India, she had read Still Whispers or was reading Still Whispers and really liked it, and we had talked. And you know, I mentioned to her, I said, at some point, I said, you need to understand that the battle that the majority of men face, that the battle that they should be struggling against, and some don't even struggle against it, but what the flesh is going to try to convince men of, and I use that statement, is that women exist simply as a tool to help a man control his sperm count. And she looked at me and she said, nuh-uh. And I said, yes. No. Yes. That's what's going on in a man's head. Pure and simple. And unless you stand against that, it's not really something that it takes any effort to gin up that idea. That idea is pervasive and it's there. And it takes effort to say, no, that's not right. And so if what we were talking about is fighting against male entitlement by actively refusing to listen to the flesh and its endeavors to try to say that men are real and women aren't, if that's what we mean by male entitlement, then I'm right on board, because the attitude is pervasive and it's very, it feeds in so many different ways and so subtly. And I'll just tell you one way it feeds in is, for instance, let's talk about fingernail polish. My wife and I have been on vacations, and she's painted my fingernails the same color as hers. And that's fine. It's fun. You know, we went to Vegas. Both of our had our fingernails painted gold, and it was fun. The reactions we would get from people, you know, because the reason we would get those reactions where there would be that kind of jarring when men would see it, they'd be like, now women, you know, they would see it and they go, oh, that's cute. So did your wife do that? Yep. You know, oh, that's cute. You know, but the reaction from some men was this seizing, like, wait, what's going on here? Okay. And I would contend that that type of reaction is in fact an indicator that men see women as objects, that man sees women as objects because he has a whole sphere of indicators that he relies on to classify that individual as a woman. And then, in fact, the reason he's trying to classify that woman, that individual as a woman, is that he is trying to identify her as a target and a potential tool for him to use to control her sperm count. So that fear, that reaction, really comes from this process of trying to identify who is a tool and the fear of misidentifying who is a tool, or being tricked into identifying that someone is a tool for me when in fact they're not. They're a man, not a woman. And I would submit that anyone who is having those types of reactions to a man having any kind of indicator that might be interpreted as a feminine indicator, a man who is effeminate, you know, men who's like, be a man, you know, all that kind of stuff, really comes, the root of that really comes down to the reason that men want to have such clear definitions of who is a man and who is a woman is because they consider women to be different enough from men that they are in fact objects. And whether or not the men would admit that or not, I think at the base of it, those visceral reactions that men have of being either deathly afraid of anything that's feminizing or offended by anything that they would consider feminizing in terms of another man they would meet, I'm convinced that the root of that all comes back to the necessity, the absolute necessity to split the human race into two camps. Men are the ones I don't lust after. Women are the ones I lust after. And so, therefore, any feminine indicator on a man causes me confusion, and I don't like it because I need to get things categorized so I know what I can use as a tool to help control my sperm count. Anyways, I'm way over time. I got to finish this up. The second was just a little tiny piece, a little small article. And Kate Winslet, I didn't see the show, but she was on Bear Grylls' episode of Running Wild with Bear Grylls. it looked like it was a lot of fun. She was on there and, you know, I think what spent the week with him or something, running around doing all this crazy survival stuff. Did a great job. As process of that, she talked about how she instills confidence in her 14-year-old daughter, Mia, and why it's so important for her to teach Mia body positivity. So she says, "When I grew up, I never heard positive reinforcement about my body image from any female in my life," Winslet, 39, said. "I only heard negatives. That's very damaging because then you're programmed as a young woman to immediately scrutinize yourself and how you look." This is her interpretation. Winslet continues, "So I stand in front of the mirror and I say to Mia, we're so lucky that we've got a shape. We're so lucky we're curvy. We're so lucky that we've got good bums. And she'll say, Mommy, I know. Thank God. It's working. That thing I've been doing, it's paying off." Then she went on, the article goes on to say, the Titanic star also opened up about her definition of happiness, which she said isn't a search for facial or physical perfection. She added, it comes from inside. Okay. And my thoughts there really come to the flip side of the battle that women face. And we've talked about this before. We've talked about the fact that the battle that men face is with lust. The battle that women face is with fear. And in my opinion, in fact, what fuels this body image distress that many, many women have really gets down to a root of fear. And it gets down to a root of insecurity about my own capabilities. What for me it looks like is that fear generates an idea in women that I am not sufficient to make my own decisions, choose my own course in life, set my own sail, you know, rig my own cloth, get myself going, and keep myself going in the right direction. That I am inadequate. Therefore, I need someone else. And it's not someone else to be a partner with me. I really want to be queen, and I want to have someone serve me. And because there's that extra requirement, it's not about finding a partner. I've said that, you know, women are interested in finding men as a success object, someone that will take care of them and earn from them. And I've had the response from men, you know, that's not true because I have friends that are good guys and they can't get any women to date them. And the reason for that is it's more than just protect me and provide for me. It's protect me, provide for me, treat me like a queen, you know, provide well for me. I don't just want to scrape by. I want somebody who's going to let me do whatever I want, whenever I want, and he'll follow everything I say. And so the bar for what women are looking for is much higher. You have to be able to provide a nest. You have to be able to provide protection. You know, that's why muscles are a big thing for a man. Not because a woman wants to have sex with a muscly man, but because she knows that's how she can woo him, because the goal is not to have sex with him all the time. The goal is to have children and then have him face outward and protect and earn. And so there is also this mechanism in women which quantifies men as objects to be used as well, although in a different matter. However, the backwash of that that comes back against women then is this distress over body image, because they know men are visually stimulated and they know the level of the man that they can attract will be directly connected to how quote unquote hot they are. And so there is this angst, this continual, oh, is these shoes okay? Or is my hair okay? Because there is this desire to marshal resources outside of myself. And the way I marshal those resources is that I look better than everyone else. Because for women, this process, because of the fear, for women, this process of marshaling resources is a zero-sum game. And this is why there's often conflict between women. because if someone marshals a resource that I was trying to marshal, now we're going to go to war. But backing up from that, then, the question for me is, all right, then how do we help women have a better body image? And in fact, my daughter appears and has been complimented by other women on how she seems to be comfortable in her own skin. And I would attribute that to the fact that my daughter has learned and was pretty much always had the mindset that I am capable, I can do things, and I can do things for myself, and I can accomplish things as myself. I don't need to hang off a guy's arm in order to be fulfilled in life. She has a wonderful husband. She certainly is happy to relegate some of the roles that, you know, like protection of the family to her husband. But I have no doubt whatsoever that if needed, my daughter would step up and take those roles too, because she is confident in her abilities and she's confident in who she is. And that understanding that I am a capable person, that I can make my own decisions, make my own choices, I can provide for myself, I can make my own way in life, that understanding then diminishes struggles with her body image. Because your body image difficulties, I personally think, come straight from fear. And therefore, if you can address the fear, you can diminish that. So I think it's fine that Kate Winslet is standing in front of a mirror with her daughter and say, oh, isn't it glorious that we have curvy bodies? And her daughter saying, oh, yeah, that's wonderful. But the sad fact is that at some point, someone is going to try to convince that daughter that her body is not sufficient, that if she was better looking or had thinner thighs or had a thigh gap or a bigger butt or a smaller butt, or if she was taller or if she was shorter, that she could attract more guys. And if she still has this underlying fear and this underlying conviction that I cannot stand on my own, I am not sufficient to provide for myself and protect myself, then if she has that fear that she is not sufficient, she's going to constantly be looking outward for clues to see how she's doing in terms of attracting extra resources to herself. And that is a trap. Because there will always be someone who is better looking. There will always be someone who is more gregarious. There will always be someone who will come waltzing in and try to suck up all the oxygen in the room. And if you're convinced that you're not sufficient within yourself to survive and have a good life, then your focus will always be outward. And you can try to convince yourself that, oh, I'm so curvy and how lucky I am and all that kind of stuff. But as long as there is this preoccupation with the external rather than building up the capabilities of the internal, you leave yourself vulnerable to the whims and the dictates of people who are external to you telling you whether you're sufficient or not, and you're much more likely to believe it. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home because I have to stop because this has run long, too long. Sorry. Until next week, have a great week.